thanks very much. It's an honour to be here. I suppose my qualifications. I started long ago as a political reporter in the House of Commons. I had a career where I wrote for The Guardian, The New York Times, and I made a lot of documentary films. In the course of that career, I met hundreds of political leaders, and not just democratic leaders, but leaders of organisations like the IRA, people in Hezbollah, in Hamas, third world dictators, even archbishops, etc. I've always been very interested in the presentation of power. And what I was going to talk today about is the coronation speech, the speech that either you or your clients have been practicing in the bathroom since they were 6 years old. That moment when you finally get on the podium, you beat up all your other rivals, and you there present yourself to the people. That moment that you've dreamed of. Mine's is the Oscar. But anyway, so here we have it. It's the moment of truth. Now, if this is going to work. Yes. Back away. Fall of Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Oh, where is he? Oh, it is a good question. Because he's virtually disappeared from public life. But Gordon Brown was a political colossus. He and Tony Blair dominated the New Labour movement, or the party and government, for 20 years. They're one of the most actually successful governments in British political history, and he was the longest-serving Chancellor of the Exchequer. That movement, the New Labour, was really a partnership between Tony Blair, who we can see is quite photogenic, and this grumpy old Scots guy, who was the figures guy in the back room. But over time, their first election victory was 1997. Over time, Brown wanted the crown for himself. And so he waged a guerrilla war inside the government to get rid of Tony Blair. And he succeeded, around about 2005, getting Tony Blair to agree to leave power. And I'd like to quote here from the ministerial verbatim record. "When are you going to fuck off? I want the job now." And Blair agreed. And then in 2007, Gordon Brown took over. The speech that we're just about to see here was 2 years, if not a lifetime, in the making.
Change to protect and extend the British way of life. and this need for change cannot be met by the old politics. So I will reach out beyond narrow party interests. I will build a government that uses all the talents. I will invite men and women of goodwill to contribute their energies in a new spirit of public service to make our nation what it can be. And I am convinced that there is no weakness in Britain today that cannot be overcome by the strength of the British people. On this day, I remember words that have stayed with me since my childhood and which matter a great deal to me today. My school motto, I will try my utmost. This is my promise to all of the people of Britain. And now let the work of change begin.
So, hard to believe, I made a play out of that speech. There was 200 performances, two large section in the West End. It's 322 words long. It was also constructed out of a focus group, a secret focus group operation called Operation Volvo that began in 2005, in which everything about that speech is constructed and formulated. I wonder, can anyone recognise the sort of familiar tropes and the main key message? Change. Change. His pollster, Deborah Matteson, Britain's Future or Britain Thinks. They did endless focus groups. The reason why that secret operation was called Operation Volvo, anyone got a guess? That's the car that the focus groups thought Gordon Brown drove. anyone got an idea of what his favourite drink was?
Whiskey.
No, not bad. Newcastle Brown Ale. And what other animal? What animal was Gordon Brown? Bear. Brilliant. Jesus. You might be doing professionally. Now, of course, there was a rival as well. Yeah. But that's what he says. The main thing was change. Change in our NHS. Change in expanding a British way of life. Another familiar complete lie and trope of every political leader, as I have travelled the country and listened and learned. And then he also said, learned and listened, he repeated it. Leaders never travel anywhere. They are always at the centre. The world comes to them. He notices even pathetically, Theresa May is using that. You think this woman, she cannot have one spare second of the day, but she is listening to everyone. Even Angela Merkel today, going to the Irish border. I mean, what kind of listening exercise will that be in the 5 minutes available? But there you go. The problem that Brown had is, of course, he had been in power. He had been in the New Labour project. He was one of the authors of the New Labour project. And the great danger about the use of the word change was, why not change the whole lot and get rid of this new old Labour and get that shiny other guy, the new leader of the Tory party, David Cameron, who was 15 years younger than Brown, photogenic, a father, a very nice little family, not grumpy, not Scottish, and new. So how the whole speech was then, it was constructed around creating a different image from Brown than Blair as the father of the nation, that they were playing to his strengths. So you've got the other tropes of listen and learn, but you had my mission, and then strong in purpose, steadfast in will. I love that. We put that in the play, steadfast in will. What a word, you know? Actually, the etymology of steadfast comes from Milton's Paradise Lost. Now, the thing was that Brown was anything but steadfast in will. That he was one of the most indecisive men ever to enter 10 Downing Street. In that first summer, that speech was in June of 2007, and he had lots of little successes. There was a little terrorist attack in Glasgow airport. There was a little outbreak of foot and mouth disease, and he used to appear in public, and he represented himself to the British people. And I thought, my God, he's doing quite okay. But he, unlike Tony Blair, Gordon Brown was he's someone who fretted. Although he hid it, he actually was blind. He could be registered blind. I say that, and why it was important, because it led to a sort of deep sense of insecurity. His speeches, if you were his speech writer, you had to deliver each speech in Arial, in caps, 16 point in bold. It led to a certain sense of threat that he was quite resistant to change. And although in that speech he's presenting himself as open to all the talents, really he was one of the most undelegating leaders. His team didn't delegate, he didn't delegate. He used to write his own speeches, rewrite his own press releases. And when he got to Downing Street, he was just simply overwhelmed by the sheer number of decisions that the Prime Minister had to make, unlike the Chancellor of the Exchequer. The Chancellor of the Exchequer makes one huge set of decisions once a year. In Downing Street, he had to make lots of big decisions almost every day. And his natural inclination was to sort of hide away and do all the research himself and concentrate until he found the solution. So it was kind of fatal. And then he fell into his fatal flaw, which was hubris. Someone suggested in his team that they should go for a snap election. His polling rose to 44%, 13% above the Conservatives. Here now was the moment that they could win a five-year term, his own electoral mandate. But he was such an indecisive person that he couldn't decide either way. And so the speculation ran on and on and on. But in the real world, the Labour Party and his team started printing election leaflets. They'd set the clock running. Everyone expected that this election was going to take place until they did some more focus groups. And it turned out that when, even despite this enhanced image, when you went to the English, to the southern marginal polling constituencies, and you asked them, who did you want to invite round to the barbecue? They said, we'd quite like to invite Dave round in his Mercedes for his white wine spritzer. And the polling dropped away, and suddenly what had appeared to be this massive lead in the polls dropped to possibly a majority of less than six. But Brown had left it too late, and he was hammered for it. He changed within 5 months, being the father of the nation, to being Butler Brown. And he really was a lame duck prime minister after that. The only man, as David Cameron skewered him in the House of Commons, the only leader in British political history who flunked an election because he thought he could win it. So that never happened. But what you do, I think, here, well, to end the story, in 2008, the banking crash came. It turned out to be actually Gordon Brown's finest moment, that he did hugely help save the world. The pressure of events made him a far more decisive leader. But his moment was over, that the crown of power that he had longed for all of his life, since he was at least 12, had crumbled into dust by his own fall within 5 months. It's an amazing fall, and everything to do with character. But in this speech, what you're doing is presenting a man, his authenticity. That's what he wanted to do. He suddenly wanted to remake himself new. Listen and learn my mission. There's quite strange little rhetorical sweeps where he just, if you listen, the syntax of the speech doesn't run like a speech. It's a series of paragraphs laid on next to each other. I will try my utmost. That was his school motto. It was actually a very successful speech. But what I've learned, and what I learned in also writing it, the best speeches are like a bright and shining lie, that the aura and mastery of them confuse and dazzle the audience. And they don't see beyond that speech to the man, beyond the character with his flaws. The trouble that you all have for you and your clients is you might do a bright and shining lie, but after time, and particularly under the pressure of events, like Gordon Brown, that lie will be exposed. And the speech itself, the planning of it, this creation of the father of the nation, that fails in the end. So I thought we'd also have another little film, which is, let's say, even more, how can I say, jaundiced view of what it takes to be an MP. It's interesting about Brown is that when you look at the House of Commons, there's 650 people. They're all individuals. But of that, each of those generation, only less than a handful on either side in each political party are likely to be potential leaders. When Tony Blair entered Parliament along with Gordon Brown in 1983, it was almost instantly recognised that Tony Blair was a potential leader. And he was a potential leader because he had many of the qualities. Does anyone know what the first prerequisite of political leadership is?
Being tall.
Good man. Excellent. The second?
Communication.
No, hair on your head. Baldies don't get elected. In the 19th century, the average height of every American president is 5'11". In the 20th century, it was 6 foot. Leaders are 1.5 times the size of ordinary folk. There are very few women. There are very few women. We don't have that enough of a track record, but it's not a coincidence. It begins in the basketball team or in the debating team when you have the tall kid and he gets picked and he gets chosen and you have that automatic assumption. It is our own physiological prejudice. The best way of explaining this is to look at afternoon TV or at every cable news show, the man and the woman. Yeah? It's a very, very familiar trope. It's a silver-haired veteran and his simpering second wife. And the reason why they do that is because photogenically, that is the one that gives them the most ratings. And we reflect that in our own prejudices. So our prejudices which create the leaders that we have. But anyway, you can watch this little film. I hope it's going to work. Here we go.
You know, anyone can become an MP. Suck up to a few cronies, lick a few asses, flatter some gutless wee trade union hack, set for you. Lay into the scrounging poor if you're New Labour. Become Mother Teresa of the NHS if you're a Tory. Elbow your way to the front of the youngling pack, through the south door. Make the trade. Tell them what they want to hear. Present yourself to the people after you've made sure the contest is fixed. Get elected. That fumbled wee speech in the drafty town hall is the pinnacle. The people of Killing Myself Shall Not are by my victory here tonight, sending out a clear message to the heart of nothing. Birkingham West are fodder. There for the numbers. Pawns to be played. Run the government department. Most of them couldn't run a fucking public toilet in Indonesia. They have no idea. Because they have no ideas. No plan. Apart from being a mean MP. British politics. Hollywood for fucking gnomes.
Anyway. A little bit cynical, a little bit cynical. But it is interesting how, I mean, one of the most interesting things coming out of the current Brexit debate is all the MPs that you've never, ever heard of before who are suddenly getting their moment. And why is it that this incredibly competitive group of people, you know, it takes a lot. There's only 650 MPs out of a population of 60 million or more. Those 650, how did they get to be in that position? And the ones that we can see in that position, how do they actually fail so miserably to be leaders? But I think this is partly, obviously, in who they are, their presentation, and obviously also in what we see in them, in their speech writing, in how they purport themselves, what image and impression, and what is that quality that makes someone a leader? Part of Brown's agony was that when he entered Parliament, Tony Blair was his apprentice. Tony Blair was had no track record in the British Labour Party. Brown had 20 years experience on him, knew much more, knew how to write, had many better leadership skills. But Tony Blair outclassed the master. He just seemed to be, he had that photogenic quality, and he had a mastery of the political arts that Gordon Brown never had. And that's one of the tragedies of Gordon Brown. There's a line in the play where, excuse me, where Gordon Brown says, you know, I went around sharpening my pencils as I sharpened his profile. And that's what happened, is that the apprentice overtook the master and surpassed him. And it was only when Brown, the fall of New Labour came, when Brown, in his kind of grumpiness, his desire for the crown, wanted to overthrow someone who was much better at selling the arts, who appeared far more authentic to the general public than Gordon Brown ever did. Yep, that's it. I think there's time for some questions, if anyone would like to.